Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello. Welcome to the Movement and Mobility series. This series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Alize Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Professor Charles Piel, a professor of cultural anthropology and African and African American studies at Duke University. We will be talking about his book, The Fixer, Visa Lottery Chronicles, published by Duke University Press in 2019. Hello, Professor Piel, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first off, I'd like to start by asking you, who is a fixer? And how does focusing on fixers broaden our understanding of mobility across national borders?
So, yeah, a fixer, I will explain a little bit about my choice of that term, but I'll come to that in a minute. A fixer in this context is a hustler. Is someone who can get done whatever needs to get done to get by, to gain access to a living, and in the context of this book, to get a visa. Getting a visa to travel in West Africa has always been difficult. Now it's more difficult than ever. And so this fixer hustler is someone who really understands a lot of the protocols for getting visas, and in this particular context, for helping people sign up for the U.S. Diversity Visa Lottery, and if they're selected, help them jump through the hoops, fulfill all the protocols at the embassy in order to acquire the visa. So that's a fixer now in West Africa. Now to the sort of naming of it. There are many terms in countries throughout West Africa about for the person I call the fixer. In Togo, which is French speaking, they call them traiteur, someone who treats documents. In Ghana next door, they use the term connection man, someone who can connect people, who has networks, who can connect people to get things done. At the U.S. Embassy in Togo and in other West African embassies, they call these intermediaries fixers, which is can be a more derogatory term than it is in its use, I think, at the embassy itself. But I chose to use it for two reasons. One is that it's a recognizable term. Traiteur, a treater, you know, wouldn't be as a title of a book. And connection man also, I think, is less, would be less known. So it's for that reason, to give it, a little more cachet, but also, and more importantly, One of the big projects of the book is to attempt to refigure how we think about the intermediary as not someone who's outside the law or against the law, but someone who actually works within the law in many ways and is someone who helps people to get what they need. And in this case, it's a visa. And Kojo, my protagonist in this book and my co-author, spends a lot of his time helping people fill out documents, meet deadlines. He speaks English as well. And many of his clients don't. So he helps them read what's on websites to get stuff in on time, to fulfill all the requirements to get the visa. So in all those ways, he's a sort of glorified intermediary who helps people get what they want.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think, even the need that people have to go to an intermediary to be able to move across borders is something very important in itself. So I was wondering, and in that respect, your book tells us a great deal about how decisions are made about movement. And, in your case, particularly from Togo to the United States. I was wondering, so how does post-coloniality figure into these decision-making processes? And also, how do these decisions shape what post-coloniality means in the Togolese context?
That's a nice question. Thanks for that. So there is a large sense in which post-coloniality figures in, and then a smaller or more narrow sense. And let me start with the more narrow sense. The U.S. Diversity Visa Lottery was established in the mid-1990s in the U.S. Congress. And there's a long and very interesting history to how it was created and a bizarre history as well that I won't go into all the details. Anyone who's interested can read the introduction to my book, and I give a quick overview of it there. But it was actually intended not for Africans, but for Europeans, and specifically for people from Ireland, for Irish. It was Ted Kennedy and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, all of these very, very powerful Irish Americans who were in U.S. Congress, who were troubled by the fact that it was very difficult for Irish to get visas to the U.S. At the time, despite the fact that that people from Ireland had been an early what's called seed population in the migrant pool in the U.S. Over a century ago, but with time had lost their opportunity to come over. And there were tens of thousands of them here who wanted to get regularized. So these folks in Congress decided to try and figure out a way to do it. And they came up with this very interesting idea of a U.S. diversity visa lottery to try and diversify the U.S. population. And since not many Irish were able to get visas, they fell into that category. Of course, they couldn't set it up for a single country, this visa lottery system, so they did it worldwide. And they didn't imagine that Africans who were a terribly underrepresented population in the U.S. Would take advantage of it. But lo and behold, pretty quickly, Africans, when they got word of the system, began to apply in great numbers. And since 1995, from 1995 to the present, Africans have been the largest winners every year. It's a very small pool of people who get selected. 50,000 people are given visas. About 100,000 are selected out of up to 20 million applicants every year. But a majority of those applicants are from the continent, and a majority of the winners are from the continent as well. So it's an example of a way in which post-colonial peoples have hijacked, if you will, a visa system and use it to their benefit. So in that sense, the visa lottery system has been sort of refigured by the post-colonial. In the larger sense, if you think about global migration today, at least up until the moment of COVID, it's difficult to get precise numbers, but at least 70 million people have been on the move for the last 15, 20 years globally. And there's a large, as Shilin Bembe puts it, a large repeopling, repopulating of the globe underway, of people moving often from post colonies to the metropole. Why is that? Because of the precarious conditions they live in, the abject, often abject economic and political conditions they live in. They feel that they have a right to movement and a right to the spoils of the world. After all, it was mostly people in the colonies in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, who contributed to the fabulous wealth that was built up in Europe and in the U.S. Over the past several centuries. Why shouldn't they have a right to that wealth? So it's for that reason that I think this is sort of centrally a post-colonial phenomenon, the phenomenon of global migration, of people moving from precarious countries and regions and continents to metropolitan areas.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. You really touched upon a very, important point where, all these phenomena that we're seeing are actually rooted in inequality. In your book, despite these inequalities, we see that, questions of luck, authenticity, and migration become entangled. I wonder how these relationships unsettle the distinctions between the supposedly formal and informal sides of the diversity visa lottery in Lomé.
So those are complicated questions about which I deal with at some length in the text about luck, about authenticity. Let me start with authenticity. A lot of the book is about the back and forth, what I at some points call the cat and mouse game between the street, the Togolese street, those who apply for the visa lottery, and the embassy. The gatekeepers at the embassy are trying to confirm that the person who applied and now during an embassy interview, if they were selected, the person standing before them is indeed who they say they are, is indeed married to the person they claim they're married to, and would be an appropriate person to give a visa to, ultimately would be a good and moral citizen in the U.S. So a lot of the book is actually focused on that micro encounter in the embassy. I discovered very quickly that a lot of the criteria for evaluating an applicant on the part of the consul, the person who will give out a visa at the embassy, have to do with a judgment about that person's character. As I said, whether they are who they say they are, so identity fraud would be a huge no-no and would lead to a quick denial of a visa. Marrying someone who is not your real wife would be similar, and so on. So there is a desire to identify an authentic subject, let's put it that way, and give visas to those people. Now, I followed, so a lot of the reason that marriages occur at, well, let me step back. So you get selected in the visa lottery. You have to go for an embassy interview for them to check out your documents. There are a couple of criteria that you have to meet. One is to have a high school diploma. Another is to have a job on the U.S. Labor Department job list. So you go to the embassy for them to verify one or the other of those. At that time, you have to pay a significant amount of money. It was over $800 until a few years ago. Now it's dropped until it's dropped to $330. That's just for the embassy interview. That's the embassy interview fee. You have to pay several hundred dollars for a medical exam. You have to pay up to $1,000 for to have your documents translated and verified, to get a passport. And you have to have another $1,000 in your pocket to buy a ticket, a plane ticket to the U.S. And you have to leave within 6 months after you get the visa. So it's a significant sum of money for Togolese, most of whom, even middle class Togolese, don't have that amount of money sitting around in a bank account or under a mattress. So what they do is, until recently, it's changed a bit recently, but what they have done for many years is to arrange a marriage. And this is where the fixer comes in, the broker. They arrange a marriage with someone who has means, a Togolese, a well-heeled Togolese person, could be a customs agent at the port. They tend to be quite wealthy. It could be a minister. And in fact, Kodjo has several ministers who are clients of his. He's helped arrange marriages with children of theirs to go to the States. Or it could be someone who's already in the States, who came over the visa lottery or by other means, and wants to bring their spouse over. They didn't bring them at the time, or they met them later, and they want to bring them over now. Or it could be someone who has a sister back home and wants to bring her over, or a friend, and so on. Those people, the customs agent in Togo, of course, the minister in Togo, or someone already in the diaspora, are likely to have the means to be able to bankroll the couple. And to pay all of the fees for the winner of the visa lottery. When Kodjo finds someone like that, if he has a client who doesn't have the means and he finds someone who's willing to pay, they arrange a marriage between the winner and the person who's willing to pay. Now, those are the marriages that the U.S. Embassy feels are fraudulent. They call them pop-up marriages. So it's actually after someone has been selected, you're still allowed to add a spouse, and they will they'll marry them, and they show up on the application as a recent marriage since the person applied. And those are the marriages that the consulate goes after and interrogates in great detail. And Kodjo is sort of a seasoned pro at this, and he prepares people for the interview, for the interrogation, where they will ask questions of the couple, separated. They separate them out. What side of the bed do you sleep on? Then they'll ask the other partner the same question. What's your favorite color? What's your husband's favorite color? What did you have for dinner yesterday? And so on and so on. This is all trying to get at the authenticity of the couple, right? As I was describing earlier, are they a real couple or not? One of the things I discovered as I was doing this research was that, interestingly, even surprisingly, a number of these arranged marriages become real, if we want to use that term. So they are people who meet through the visa lottery fall for each other at some point along the way, whether it's in Togo, whether it's they usually travel together because the financier buys the plane tickets for both, They often live together in the States until their green card arrives. So that can be for several months. It could be for a year or two. I have met and heard about through Kojo quite a few couples like this who've fallen for each other. So, again, if we want to use this term, become real along the way. Once I asked Kojo about this, about the arranged marriage phenomenon, and then it's that that really sets off the consuls. And he responded very matter-of-factly, what's the difference between meeting your partner at the beach, at the shopping mall, or through the lottery? And I thought that was a very clever and sort of insightful response. So that's to address the question of authenticity that you asked, that these notions of what Americans consider authentic, what Togolese considered authentic when it comes to relationships, when it comes to human relations, are complex and in many cases at odds. So the book is, in part, one of the sub themes of the book is about this medley of this sort of competition between different notions of authenticity, culturally given authenticity, American on the one hand and Togolese on the other. As to the question of luck, so, you know, that's of course, an important category in Euro-American societies, that there's randomness in the world, that there is luck to my being selected, my getting a job, and so on, as well as merit, of course. But it's an important cultural category for Euro-Americans, and less so for Togolese. I don't know if it's true of, beyond Togo to West Africa more generally. My guess is that it is. For Togolese, things always happen for a reason, and you can control your fate. So Togolese love the fact that it's a lottery that selects them, but they add to that. They say, well, I was selected by the lottery, but there's a reason, either a divine reason or something that I did that enabled my name to pop up, that enabled me to be selected. And so there's no sort of pure category of luck for them or randomness for them, at least for those people I know. So they are throughout the process doing all they can to increase their luck. Let's put it that way. So they go to church more often. Togolese are quite religious. Many of them are Christian, Pentecostal. They go to church every day of the week now, once they've applied and before the selection process, they forsake sinful ways. I have some wonderful stories of people who, were philanderers and stopped their philandering ways when they applied for or after they were selected in the visa lottery before the embassy interview. If people are not Christian, they may go back to the village and do ceremonies there to increase their chances and so on. So luck is a really interesting category. It's something that I write about a little bit in this text. It's something that I may pursue a bit more down the road because it's also a complex category. So I think maybe that is a response to your two questions there about authenticity and luck.
Of course. This was a great response, actually. I mean, it's fascinating to me that, the making of an authentic subject is sort of part of what Kojo does, but yet it's sort of a fragile subject. Like we see him, not succeed in presenting himself as an authentic subject to the embassy, which I found, very interesting, again, circling back to this question of luck.
Yes, Kodjo's case is fascinating. I mean, here is the most brilliant broker in Lomé, who most of whose clients get visas. And he's, you know, thanks to him, he coaches them, he tutors them, he anticipates every situation at the embassy that could occur. He schools his clients in how to respond to them and so on and so on. And against all odds, most of his clients get through. He himself has never gotten through. He's applied now for over 20 years and never been selected. He has married himself to three different women, and every time something has gone awry. Not his own doing, but the doing of usually the other party. The first person, a young woman, was just so panicked, even though she'd been coached by Kodjo for several months. She was so panicked on the day of the embassy interview that she just completely froze up, and no words, easy question after easy question from the consul, no words came out of her mouth. They failed. And he married two other people, and one thing or another went wrong. So it's one of the great ironies at the heart of this project for me, that the most brilliant visa broker in the area is able to get visas for everyone else except for himself.
Speaking of Kodjo, reading the book, I kept wondering what your fieldwork looked like. In the book, you mentioned some of your ethical concerns around making his tricks of the trade, so to speak, legible by writing about them. So I'm wondering, how did you work through these concerns, particularly as you were doing the research?
So the great dilemma for me in publishing this text was whether to publish it all, because as you can tell from my last couple of answers, a lot of my research time was spent, and a lot of the text itself is also spent documenting sort of tricks of the trade, secrets of the street, how people get by on the consuls. So the worry, of course, and this is an age old worry for anthropologists, who most of us deeply want to protect our research subjects from the ill effects of power and prejudice and so on. So should I publish a book about secrets, about trade secrets? And wouldn't I be at some level harming future Togolese who were also applying for the visa lottery? So I was asked this by friends. I gave talks about this material, and people in the audience would ask this question. It was almost always the first question. Friends of mine, colleagues of mine in my home university constantly asked me, students asked me, and so on. And I for the longest time, wasn't sure. I asked Kodjo. I asked some esteemed colleagues of mine, Achille Mbembe, Francis Nyamjo, African colleagues. And the answer from both Kodjo and them was, without hesitation, yes, you need to publish. They said a number of things. So Mbembe and Nyamjo said, it's a wonderful illustration of West African street savvy. And if appropriately contexted, placed into context of precarity and abjection in this area of the world today, it makes an important contribution to our understanding of the area. And besides which, it's unlikely that flat-footed consuls would be able to keep up with someone as clever as Kojo, all of which is true. I asked Kojo, and he gave a series of really interesting and thoughtful responses. One was that the consoles know all of this stuff already. Everything in the book that you're going to publish, they have seen and they've known about for at least the last 15 years, which is certainly true. I interviewed the consoles, several generations of consoles, over the last 10 years or so, and they do know all of this material. And Kojo added to that, he said, you know, my practice is constantly changing, so my strategies are different from one year to the next. And if the consoles use your book as a manual, they'll be looking in all the wrong places. In fact, I'd be delighted if they used it as a manual, because I'm working in a different register today. And then he added as well that two more things. One was that as I had told him for many years, and as he's been entirely aware of himself, he writes me and asks me this question every year: is the Visa lottery going to be done away with this year? Republicans in U.S. Congress have tried to eliminate it for the last 20 years. Donald Trump himself has been out to do it in. And we can talk maybe later about the current status of it. It's been suspended until the end of COVID. They're hoping, of course, to eliminate it altogether. So every year it's under threat. It has never been voted out, because in order to do so, it has to be an act of Congress, and they will have to pass a new immigration bill. And the Democrats and Republicans haven't been able to agree on one for over 20 years. So it's still in play. I tell Kojo every year, it's quite likely that by the time this book sees the light of day, it will have been eliminated. And indeed, we'll see in the next year. The book just came out. The program is currently in suspension, and it may be eliminated. But especially if Trump is able to agree to DACA in return for getting rid of the visa lottery and a few other aspects of the current immigration bill. That was his third response. And the fourth was and this was sort of his agenda, his large agenda in the beginning, when he agreed to speak to me at length about this material. And I should just add here, he was extraordinarily open and surprisingly to me, open. We were very good friends going into this, but this is his business. This is his livelihood. This is his passion. And to risk having all of these state secrets published, to me was for him to assume a fairly large risk. But he was willing to do it. I can talk more if you want about some of the reasons why, I think. But the final reason, which was I think his biggest reason, is that he's an intense critic of embassy practice because it's his business, but because he follows it very closely. And he knows when people make mistakes at the embassy, as they do. I mean, a very complicated set of rules and procedures to apply, of deadlines, and this, that, and the other. And he knows when they make mistakes. And he wanted me to publish this book in part to correct their mistakes and to bring to the attention of the U.S. State Department the arbitrary nature of a lot of the decision-making that goes on, and the just too quick decisions that that consuls render in evaluating Togolese lottery winners. That was his big reason for wanting the book published. And so on balance, he said, look, they know all this already. And I want you to publish this so that the embassy might, in fact, reflect on and think critically about their own practice. And I should just add here, when I was publishing this, the folks I was most nervous about and concerned about were these consuls who I had known and many of whom I became friends with and liked very much over the years, and that my book would be read as a strong critique of their practice, which I think it is. But I got an amazingly interesting and thoughtful set of emails from people at the embassy currently, saying that they'd read the book, they didn't agree with everything, but that they were going to take quite seriously some of the criticisms of current embassy protocol, that was surprising to me, and sort of went straight to Kojo's point about trying to change for the better embassy practice around the visa lottery.
It's fascinating to hear that, you know, what Kojo aimed with this book is a part of the feedback that you're getting. And on a related note, so in this interview, you referred to Kojo as your co-author, and his name also appears in the cover of the book, which is not something we see very often in anthropology books. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on that. And I was also wondering how the sensibility figured into your writing practice and how you speak about the book now.
Well, this was an easy one for me. Not only is Kojo a very good friend and was absolutely a full collaborator, a full participant in this project, but also, the book is his story. I mean, all of the stories that I tell came from him. Some of them from other people. There are other fixers who I also worked with, but it was mostly with Kojo. Whenever I was in Lomé, he lives in the capital. I've done most of my work in villages in the north, so I spend a lot of my time there. But when I'm back in the capital or when I just arrive, Kojo and I sit down every day in a little bar. Yeah, it was always the same bar called After Beach. The English terms, and we would just jump right into it. I would ask him what the latest news was about his clients, what the what some of his strategies were, and we would just spend several hours every day when I'm in the capital going through this. And still today, even after the book's done, I was in Lomé in March, and we followed the same drill. All of the book is really Kojo's. It's his story. And so the thought that he wouldn't be a co-author, would have been scandalous to me. I asked him early on when he began to tell me, I began to learn about some of these stories from him when he had married the first of his three wives, and told me how he was preparing her, and then of course what happened at the interview and so on. And I found her story and the stories of others that he was beginning to coach sort of riveting, and asked him if he minded if I would publish about them. And we had a conversation about it, and he said, "No, not at all. Go ahead." I wrote an article that was published in Politique Africaine in Paris in French. He speaks very good French. He read the article. He liked it. I said, this material is really intriguing to me. And I think very much speaks to the current global moment we're in. And I would love to publish something more substantial, maybe even a book. Would you be interested in co-authoring a text? And he said, "Let me think about it overnight." The next day he came back to me and he said, "Absolutely." And he began himself writing notes about possible chapters and so on. So we agreed right from the beginning that he would be a co-author. And the question for me at the end, his name was going to be on the book. It was whether it would be Pio and Batema or Pio with Batema. And I decided on the latter because, in fact, of course, I wrote the entire text. He doesn't, he speaks okay English, but not good enough to be able to write a text like this. And he's not an academic. So I wrote, you know, every word of the text, all of which I ran by him. I mean, he read every chapter and gave his approval or not. I mean, usually his answer was, well, yeah, this is what we talked about. You know, let's keep going. So that's the sort of authorship question. And I'm very, you know, I'm delighted that he agreed to be a co-author. I think he feels quite pleased as well. His picture is on the front cover. So what's not to like in that? And you know, I'm trying to be very careful about sharing any proceeds that the book you know will bring in. In fact, I you know I got a small early advance you know royalty payment from Duke Press and you know a couple thousand dollars and gave that all of that to him and so on, and all of the annual royalties as small as they are. Unfortunately, academic books don't bring in much money, but they will go to him as well. So you know, I think it's been a good partnership, and I'm pleased with the way it came out.
Yeah, and it definitely shows in the text. So that's wonderful to know about. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about some of the stories in the Fixer that are not necessarily centered around Kojo. So, as you say, there's an afterlife to the fantasy of the United States, and you met with some of the Togolese that actually, you know, were successful in the diversity visa lottery and ended up in the United States. I was wondering what life looks like for some of these Togolese people that you met, and, you know, especially after after the recent changes in legislations regarding this visa lottery. And I'm also wondering what kinds of labor relationships their movements sustain.
Thank you for asking that question. It's an important one. And, it, you know, I didn't know in the beginning whether the book would just be based in Lomé, you know, with people before they travel, or not, because it's a quite different story when you make the rounds of people who are already in the U.S. But I felt after I'd written most of the chapters that I really it would complete the story to make the rounds to some extent here as well, and to find out what I call the afterlife of their of their travel or their dream is. And so the second to last chapter is about that. Then after I wrote that chapter and got reviewer comments, both of my reviewers said, you know, it would be nice now to take the narrative back to Lomé and have a short final chapter based in Lomé for you to take some of the conclusions, some of the insights of your travels in the U.S. back to Kojo and see how he responds. And so that's what I did. I actually made a short trip back to Lomé in February 2 years ago and sat down with Kojo for a week and then wrote a short sort of postscript out of that. So, yes, the following people who were in the States. Now, this was originally going to be a Kojo story as well. I was hoping to be able to get him a visa to come to the States and make the rounds with me of his clients. So people whose stories I write about in the earlier chapters, that we would actually visit them and see how they're doing. And I knew a consul quite well at the time who knew about Kojo. He'd read a couple of articles I'd written about him. He also knew that Kojo had been imprisoned in Ouagadougou in Burkina Faso by the embassy at one point, and had tried to get a visa through by marrying a couple of women. But his only concern was whether Kojo would stay in the States or not. And he was convinced that he wouldn't, because he knew that he was doing really good business in Togo. And Kojo has told me many times he would love to come. He would love to see friends here, and he would go back home. And I'm sure that's the case. In any case, I tried to get Kojo a visa, and I won't go into the details of it, but there was an unfortunate for Kojo event that occurred a few weeks before he went in for the visa interview, in which one of his clients, for the first time, I think, was upset with him and went to the embassy to complain, and falsely suggested that Kojo was trying to extort her. And she wrote his name down, and the consul had his name when he came in. He talked to him for 15 minutes, but he said, sorry, je suis désolé, I can't give you the visa. And I later found out why. So I was hoping, and I was convinced that he would get the visa and that we would have a really interesting trip in the States together, but that didn't work out. So in place of Kojo, I was fortunate to know a really good friend of Kojo's and someone who knows many of Kojo's clients from Lomé. But this friend, Jeannot, lives in the States now in Raleigh, North Carolina. And although he's just moved his family back to Lomé, he's actually returned, but he comes and goes. And he was a good friend who had actually lived in our house for 6 months at one point when he came over. And he agreed to make the rounds with me. And so we made several trips, one to Newark, New Jersey, where Jeannot had first lived when he arrived, one to Omaha, Nebraska, which is a real a sort of entrepot and sort of, you know, center for Togolese in the States. It's called Togoville or Petit Togo. There are a lot of Togolese in Omaha, Moline, Illinois, Raleigh, of course, in North Carolina, and so on. And I was interested just in seeing how folks are doing. And we spent 3, 4, 5 days in each place and made the rounds. And, you know, mostly people who Jeannot knew or had heard about. Or, you know, sort of snowball sampling, you know, one person would tell us, oh, you've got to talk to so-and-so. And you know, my questions were, so what is life like now that you're here? What's your work like? Are you able to make a living? How much money do you send back each year? Do you visit? And do you want to go back home? And the story was amazingly consistent. There were a few. So first, everyone, because they have the green card, they automatically get the green card when they pass the embassy interview back home. Because they have the green card, they get jobs right away. And they're at least minimum wage jobs, sometimes better, but usually not. Working in Walmart, working in meatpacking plants. A lot of Togolese are working in meatpacking plants in the Midwest. Working at the airport in Newark, and so on. But they're full-time jobs and usually with at least marginal benefits. Even on minimum wage and working long hours, they can get by here and send money home every month. So in that sense, they all consider their stories success stories. Many of them work more than one job so they can have more money to send home. Most of them cannot afford to buy a house here. They hope to be able to buy a car a large TV set and pay the rent. So they are, small success stories in that sense, and they would all agree to that. But at a larger level, they all miss home. The parents do, the ones who won the visa lottery. Their children become Americanized pretty quickly. They have West African parents, Togolese parents, and so eat Togolese food at home and speak one of the Togolese languages, as well as French. But they learn English quickly. They go to U.S. schools. They become culturally literate. And their friends are here. They're not back in Togo. So their children become Americanized and actually succeed. We have many students that several students at Duke whose parents were diversity visa lottery winners and did very well in the school system and get into good colleges. But the parents themselves all miss home, and to a person, there were one or two cases where people said no, they would stay, but almost everyone else said that they would return to Lomé tomorrow if only they could get a decent job there. To me, that was a sad finding and a sad outcome to this this story of dreams. People wanting to leave home because of precarity, of dreaming about an elsewhere, in this case, the U.S. winning, being selected in the visa lottery, and then miraculously passing the embassy interview and having the visa to travel. And you should see people back home when they get visas in their passports. They show the passport and the visa to everyone. It's a real badge of honor and a notable achievement. So after all of that and finding the money to travel and getting a job. 5 years in, 10 years in, they all would prefer to be back home. They say this isn't our culture. We don't make enough money to really enjoy life in the U.S. You need more than minimum wage to do that. We don't know where to go on the weekends to find entertainment. This is your your society. We know that you guys like to go out to eat with your families on the weekends. We can't afford that. To take my family of four to a restaurant will cost me over $100. That's more money than I have. So we just stay home. We watch TV. We eat our own food, which is terrific, but we still miss the food in Lomé more. It's better when you eat with your friends. They miss the social life. They miss, hearing the language spoken in the streets and markets and so on. So to me, that finding and that sort of end to the book was a sad and even semi-tragic ending. Of course, most of them, I know a few. Jeannot has just gone back. He's done quite well. He's an amazingly impressive entrepreneur in his own right. And he's done well enough to be able to move his family back to Lomé to build a nice house there. He has three daughters who are all in school there. And he comes and goes. He's in Raleigh right now during COVID, working for Amazon. But most people don't do as well as Jeannot and don't have his sense of adventure and entrepreneurialism. He's been able to do it. Most others can't. And they're stuck here because of that. If they tried to go home without money, without a job, people would, family members would say, "What are you doing? You've been supporting us all this time, and now you're coming back here, and we aren't going to have that support," and so on. And just one other little sort of anecdote there. I have seen, so they don't move back, but they, after they're established here and, have a U.S. passport, they have to wait usually 5 years for that. They will ideally go back and visit once a year or every other year. And they love to go back during holiday season around in December and to take a month or 6 weeks. And I have seen many of them who were clients of Kojo's and others when they come back to Lomé. They are the happiest people you have ever seen. They're with their friends. It's a hot season, so, you know, it's a hot time of year, but they love the heat too. The cold of the American Midwest is not something they ever really get used to. They go out with their friends every night. They go out and eat fufu in the food bars of Lomé with their friends. And of course they treat everyone. And they just have the time of their lives and take gifts to their family members and so on. What I realized after I'd seen a few of them is that they, against what their experience is here in the U.S., which is just making enough money to get by, minimum wage, and years of not unhappiness, but, wishing that it were different. When they go home to Lomé, they never tell people what it's like here, and they don't tell current visa lottery winners before they've come over what it's like here. They instead perform success. They rent big flashy cars. If they aren't staying with family members, they rent a nice apartment in Lomé. They take their friends out every night as if they were towering successes, which isn't their story at all for most of them. I've asked them why they don't tell people what it's really like. And they say, you just can't. Why not? Because they wouldn't believe you. They see the money coming back every month. They watch TV. They see how people live here and imagine that everyone lives that way. And they would wonder what you were trying to hide from them, what I was trying to hide from them. So it's a large secret that keeps alive the fantasy back home and keeps people moving across the ocean. Can never be told by people who were here and living the other side of the dream, the afterlife of the dream and the sad afterlife that often is. They said that to demystify it just wouldn't work. So it's an interesting part of this puzzle that sort of keeps, that speaks to mobility and global mobility as well. These sort of fantasies and secrets, I think, are tied up with these migrations and sort of mobility dynamics.
Thank you very much, Professor Pio, for giving us insight into sort of the afterlife of these movements. And in general, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us and your insights.
Thank you, Elise. It was my pleasure as well. I appreciate it.
So on that note, I am Aliza Arıcan. This discussion of the Fixer Visa Lottery Chronicles, published by Duke University Press in 2019, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.